Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, I came upon the child of God. He was walking along the road, and I asked him, tell me, where are you going, Mr. Coleman? Said, I'm going down to Yasgur's farm.
So are you there in the mud at Max Yasgur's farm? Or screaming when the Beatles play Shea Stadium? At the Stone Pony to see Bruce Springsteen? At the Apollo to see James Brown? Were you there when Elvis left the building? Or are you more likely to be found in the mosh pit at CBGB's, or at the front and center table at the Bottom Line, or the Blue Note? Well, in these days of music as an experience between you and your earbuds, let's take a moment to celebrate the collective experience known as a concert. What concert meant to most of you and was the music. Was it the music that sticks with you, or was it how it fit into your life? Was it a first date? Was it something political or sociocultural? Did you get arrested? Did you end up dancing on the stage? Well, for the new collection of essays called The Show I'll Never Forget, 50 writers relive their most memorable concert-going experience, editor Sean Manning asked some of his favorite writers to talk about the concerts that meant something in their lives. In the next hour, we will hear from Sean Manning and four of the 50 contributors, and we will take some of your calls about your most memorable concert-going experiences. And even more important, why do you remember that particular concert? What did it say about who you were or who we were? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Sean Manning joins us now from WCPN in Cleveland. And with us, too, is Sigrid Nunez, who went to that music festival that started as a concert and ended as a generation gap, Woodstock itself. Welcome to WNYC, Sean and Sigrid. Good morning.
Hello, Brian.
Good morning.
How are you?
And Sean, the book moves chronologically, I'll tell our listeners, and begins with Ishmael Reed remembering a Miles Davis concert in 1965 through to a Metric concert in 2005. And the impact of many of the concerts is personal. But for sociological impact, you can't get much bigger than Woodstock. And
that's
Sigrid,
right.
Is that why you picked it?
Yes, I did. It was certainly my most memorable concert. Among other things, it was actually my first rock and roll concert.
What stayed with you? The music, the crowd, or just the fact that you were there?
Well, in fact, I think that the music, this was one concert where the music was less important even though they had all these wonderful acts, than the scene. You know, acres of hippie. It was like a hallucination in itself. And then, I mean, you got more of a sense, perhaps, of the music from the movie, not to mention that some of the acts weren't at their best because it was impossible to be so under those conditions. And but just the idea that if you were there, you were at the center of the youthquake, and it was something that for a long time afterwards, you know, people would say, you were there, and you'd be thrilled to be able to say that you were. Until after a certain point, to say that you were meant that you were 30, and then it meant you were 35, and then it meant you were 40. And
is that why you wrote?
On?
Yeah, is that why you wrote that you came to be embarrassed by it?
I think that you know, when there were a group of students that undergraduates that wanted me to go out for, they said we want to take you out for a drink, and as soon as we sat down, they said, we want to hear about Woodstock. And this was, I think, in the late 90s, maybe 97, 98. And talking about it, I did feel a certain embarrassment. And then I also remembered watching it in 96 in a hotel room in San Francisco. And, yeah, being embarrassed by many of the things that were said and a certain self-congratulatory tone and, you know, just a lot of the Flower Generation, you know, seemed kind of dumb. So yeah, there is something about it that is embarrassing to recall. A lot of it is wonderful to recall, but
I'm glad you're here, by the way, because I get the chance to tell you how much I'm enjoying your novel The Last of Her Kind, which I happen to be in the middle of, And that's kind of a life and times novel for a certain set of baby boomers. And you actually have a scene that takes place at Woodstock.
Yes.
Sean, what were you looking for in the essays? Musical criticism, sociological analysis, as, by the way, we listened to Santana in one of the pieces they did at Woodstock. Memoir, what were you looking for?
Yeah, that drum solo is long, man. That is. I was looking for, I think it's funny because Sigrid mentions about the students that had come up to her asking to hear about Woodstock, and for me it was the exact opposite. You know, these were all writers that I admired, and I was looking for more of a kind of an insight to their personal lives and their own background. I was less interested in the concert than the circumstances which led them there, and so that I was more interested in the autobiographical nature of the essay.
And it is, maybe it says something about a certain period in history that people are actually able to tolerate long drum solos.
I'm telling you. But, I mean, the extended solo.
But one, and Santana's people did it better than most. But one point that comes up in several of the essays is the trickiness of memory. Sigrid, right. Was that true for you?
Oh, absolutely. Because there were, when I was writing the book and when I was talking to my students, I realized that some of what I was remembering was actually not from having seen those performers, but from seeing them a year later in the movie. The movie is terrific. And I stand firmly by the memory that I did see Sly and the Family Stone performing on Friday, but I've read that they actually performed on Saturday. So I don't really know.
And you're right about seeing a particular band. I guess that's the same story that you realized played when you weren't there.
Yeah.
So, all right. Sigrid Nunez, author of The Let. Well, actually, you want to stay and take a call or two with us?
Sure.
Could do that, along with Sean Manning, who is the editor. The editor of the show I'll Never Forget, 50 Writers Relive Their Most Memorable Concert-Going Experiences. The drum solo finally ended. And Jim in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So?
I'm just so great to hear this show and be able to share with you. When I was 15 years old, I attended, I don't know whether it was Jimi Hendrix's debut at the Fillmore East, but May 10th, 1968, which I think a lot of people must remember. It was an incredible concert at the Fillmore East because not only was Hendrix in, you know, top form, but another band debuted, and they were the most exciting thing anyone had ever seen, and that was Sly and the Family Stone.
Wow.
And the funny thing was the house lights did not dim at the beginning of the concert, and everyone was sort of looking at each other. You know, of course, everyone was very high on a lot of drugs. And suddenly, these people dressed like Apache Indians,
yes,
came down the aisles of the Fillmore doing that hand jive to dance to the music. And
were they unknown at that time or already known?
New York debut. The only thing we knew about was the recording. We'd heard the record already, but we didn't know what we were looking at. It was the most amazing spectacle.
Huh.
And they did the whole thing in the aisles until they got to the stage and then swung into the main part of the song. But the crowd was completely out of control by the time they ended the first song.
And Jimi Hendrix had a hard act to follow. Sigrid, that seemed to ring a bell with you or strike a chord?
Because a year later, then Sly and the Family Stone were at Woodstock, but so was Jimi Hendrix, and he was the grand finale, and he was one of the main reasons why a lot of people went to that concert. But the sad thing is that by the time he came on, so many people had left. I think only about a tenth of the crowd remained because it was so delayed by the time he came on late, well after dawn on Monday morning.
Reminds me of a Grateful Dead concert I once saw where the Grateful Dead didn't show up. And the first act was Buddy Miles, this kind of jazz rock thing, and it was so good. And they went for like 2 hours, and we thought, well, they're dead place for 5 hours, so we're going to be here till 9:30 tomorrow morning. And then about 2.5 hours in, they announced, we're sorry to have to tell you this, with the beat going, that the Grateful Dead are not here, but we're going to play for another 2 hours. So, sometimes the opening act makes the show. Because they have to
memorable.
Or not. All right. Sigrid Nunez, author of The Last of Her Kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we are also joined now by David Gates, novelist, short story writer, and a senior editor at Newsweek. Hi, David. Thanks for coming on with us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
What concert did you write about in this book?
It was the concert that James Brown gave in April 1968, less than 24 hours after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated in Memphis. And I had my ticket. I was reluctant, you know, to go. I wondered, should I go? Would I be safe? Would I be intruding on something that I really don't belong in anymore in this, you know, in that historical context?
And intruding because you're a white guy?
Yeah, I'm a white guy. I was a, you know, white, long-haired hippie in those days. I was 21. And finally I decided, well, I would go, that I wouldn't allow this to prevent me from going, and that I would go in part just in solidarity with people and to show that I was not afraid and that there were things maybe more important than race. Of course, white people like to think that.
That's right. Well, let's listen to a little of Please, Please, Please from James Brown live at the Apollo.
Someone to love me. Why did it happen? It's right.
All right. David Gates. It wasn't the same James Brown at the Apollo that the CD is.
No. He was, you know, it's 5 years difference. No, more than that, 6 years difference. And this was at the time that he had done Cold Sweat. It's at the time he'd done I'm Black and I'm Proud. I Can't Stand Myself When You Touch Me. He was beginning to get into the music that he just perfected so beautifully in the 70s.
You were there at a very important historical moment, as you mentioned, because it was less than a day after the Martin Luther King assassination.
Yeah.
And people talked about that a lot when James Brown died last year, that he did a lot to quell potential riots.
Yes, there
do you remember anything like that?
I remember some people rushing the stage. I don't remember it being a huge number. I remember there were cops there, and James Brown had the sense to cool these people out himself rather than having the cops deal with them.
How did he do it?
He just spoke to them. He just spoke to them very kindly and asked them to, you know, to go back, and they complied with him. And he was so respected.
You're a white kid. African Americans are rioting already in dozens of cities. Did you consider not going that night?
Oh yes, I debated it over and over again, but I just thought I really needed to go. Wanted to go and wanted to show my face there.
David Gates, contributor to Sean Manning, editor of The Show I'll Never Forget, 50 Writers Relive Their Most Memorable Concert-Going Experiences. And, Sean, were there certain historical concerts that you went looking for contributions on, like Woodstock and like James Brown right after the King assassination?
No, the whole thing was very serendipitous, actually. I was only interested in getting the writers that I wanted, and I left it up to them as far as choosing the concert, so to get Woodstock in there, to get Zeppelin, Diana O'Sullivan writes a wonderful essay on Zeppelin, to get James Brown by David Gates, the Beatles, the Stones, Bowie, it just the whole thing just kind of came together organically and on of its own. So I take no credit in that whatsoever.
Anita in the Village, you're on WNYC. What was your memorable concert?
My memorable concert was Joe Williams and Count Basie at Carnegie Hall, probably between 1975 and 1977, because I lived in Brooklyn Heights then. I remember schlepping on the subway to go see Joe and the Count.
Why that one?
Why that one? Well, I always loved black urban music. In fact, my mother had been at the Apollo that Wednesday night when Ella won the contest. So it was in my family, and I listened to the Count and Joe on records, and I always wanted to see them in person. So I went, and I was just blown away. That huge, big band and that wonderful Joe Williams with the great bass voice just coming in, just walking on stage and coming in just at the right time. and singing those songs, which were a combination of the blues and blues shouting and melody. And it was just, when I got home that night, I called all of my friends. Of course, I got home at about midnight, and I spoke about going for days and days and days. And I went alone because I knew that I just wanted that experience to be mine.
Huh. You didn't want any friends,
that's
loved
right.
ones to get
but
between
after
you.
After that, I took all of my friends.
Your reverie.
Time.
Anita, thanks a lot. And David Gates, contributor to the show I'll Never Forget, 50 Writers Relive Their Most Memorable Concert-Going Experience, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll continue with Sean Manning and two other contributors on WNYC. Back with us now, Sean Manning and some of the contributors to the book, The Show I'll Never Forget, 50 Writers Relive Their Most Memorable Concert-Going Experience. And Sean, I like this next essay because in a way it's about missing the point.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny because I immediately thought of when that caller mentioned Sly Stone coming down the aisles and the reception they got of this totally unknown group. I immediately thought of Public Enemy and Mark Nesbitt's essay and the reaction that they got, which was the exact opposite.
And Mark Nesbitt is here with us. Hi, Mark.
How's it going?
It's going good. Tell us about that show.
Well, it was, you know, I was 14 years old, and it was a dream come true because I'm going to see three basically glorified frat boys throw beer at each other. And unbeknownst to us, we didn't care who was opening up or who else was there. And then Public Enemy came out, and as I said in the essay, just got completely booed off the stage. They weren't given the chance.
Oh, so this is the opposite of the Sly and Family Stone experience. You were there to see the Beastie Boys, and Public Enemy came out, and they didn't win the crowd over.
Not even a little bit. I mean, nobody knew what to expect. It was Yo Bum Earth, the show had either just come out or was about to, and even when Public Enemy became hugely popular, that wasn't their biggest album. It was obviously Take a Nation of Millions that really got people to pay attention to them. We eventually liked Yo Bum Rush the Show, but at that point we had never heard it, and nobody up there had heard it. And they came out, and they just looked pissed off, and the crowd turned very quickly. I remember that line you was kicking me on the way out to LA, loud and trees while we was in the car on our way to the shop. Well, yo, right now, kick the bass for them brothers and let them know what goes on. And, Mark, why do you think they didn't connect since they were to go on to be so big? I just think that they were their sound. I mean, if you listen to that song right there, that, like, weird sort of buzzing sound in the background, which became a staple of their music. I mean, nobody had ever heard anything like that before, and it's just, if you've never heard it before, and it just becomes grating to some people. And that combined with the way that his just belligerent emceeing, and then you got Flavor Flav dancing around like a monkey and overalls and suspenders and leather, and it was just, and you got these guys on stage with Uzis. It was just, people had no idea what to make of any of it.
And if you're going to hear Fight for Your Right to Party and you get this,
I guess
that's a little incongruous.
And you've seen the Fight for Your Right to Party video, and it's a bunch of guys jumping on a couch and talking about my mom stole my porno mag, and then these guys come out. It's a little bit of a disconnect.
That was actually a triple bill, that show, wasn't it?
It was.
Who was the third?
The third was the Junkyard Band, which at that point, even though nobody in the Capitol Center had heard of Public Enemy, everybody loved the Junkyard Band because Go-Go was enormous at that time and still is in D.C. and the suburbs around there.
Vincent.
And they were unannounced, which was even better.
Yeah. So did this somehow set up for you an appreciation of Public Enemy for the future? Or did it make it harder?
No, it's set it up. I just felt kind of sheepish later on when I started liking him, when the album actually started getting circulation, getting played around our high school. Then, you know, me and my friend Elliot would sit there and tell people, yeah, we saw them live at the Cap Center. It was awesome. And even though we were completely lying.
Vincent in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. What's your show?
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Hey, my first show was 1976 at Madison Square Garden with Kiss during the Destroyer tour. It was a special time for me because my brother's 7 years older than me, and I was sort of included in his world. And that show sort of kicked off me being a drummer and a musician for the rest of my life. But they actually put on the best rock and roll show I've ever seen, and I haven't missed a show since.
Vincent, thanks a lot. And Sean Manning, editor of the show I'll Never Forget, 50 Writers Relive Their Most Memorable Concert-Going Experience. How wide a range of musical acts are in the book? Because we've heard about rock and roll. We've heard about R&B. We've heard about hip-hop now.
Right. There's a few incredible jazz essays. Gary Giddens, the wonderful jazz writer, preeminent jazz writer, writes about seeing the Titans of the Tenor show at Lincoln Center and how it was Coltrane and Sonny Rollins and a slew of amazing saxophonists. And there's also a wonderful essay by Richard Bergen about Bill Evans. And there's even an essay about by the writer Max Allen Collins, who's best known for wrote The Road to Perdition, which was turned into a Tom Hanks movie. He writes about his love for Bobby Darin and how he never got an opportunity to see him live, and he ended up, his most memorable concert was seeing Kevin Spacey doing Bobby Darin when he did the tour for the Beyond the Sea movie a few years back.
It covers a
wide gamut.
Any classical in the book?
No classical. No, I did not get any classical, which... much to my regret, I think that would have been wonderful to include that. And scant country music, either. David Gates does make reference to a few wonderful country music shows, but we're not able to include country there's several different styles that we didn't get to include. Dance, you name it. But I think by and large, starting in 1955, going to 2005, and 50 years, it's a pretty terrific cross section.
Let's see. We have one on our board, a lot of rock and roll, a lot of R&B, some jazz. We have one person calling in to mention a classical concert as his most memorable concert experience, and it is Larry in Manhattan. Larry, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. First of all, another good reason to contribute to WNYC is the fact that the conversation that you had with Congressman Nadler was exactly the thing I most wanted to talk about today until this topic came up. And it turned out the topic I really need to talk about today. So you have a tendency to do that.
Good. We try to get right into your brain, Larry, and say, what does Larry want today? We're your media slaves.
And you do it so well. I had to mention the concert that was done at Carnegie Hall in 1990. It could have been 91, the early months, as a memorial to Leonard Bernstein, which was just an amazing experience. The music, the musicianship, which was so extraordinary, seeing a leaderless orchestra like a leaderless horse, riderless horse, work through the overture to Candide. And also, it was about the community of people that it drew together. And Woodstock and Watkins Glen were definitely the experiences of my generation, and they kind of forged a nation. But there's this thing about community and the fact that not only do I have something in common with a lot of people, but they're my neighbors. They live right here.
There you go. And Larry, I'm going to have to leave it there. I appreciate those thoughts just because your cell phone is breaking up real bad. But thanks a lot, and we'll try to continue to be your media slaves here at WNYC. Hey, Mark, I think I have the opposite experience of you, going not expecting Public Enemy and being completely turned off. When I was a kid, I was at a summer camp, and they took us to Tanglewood to see Judy Collins, right? Nice, tame folk singer. We didn't realize that we were in for our first jazz concerts. as children. And who is the jazz group? Somebody who you may have never heard of, called the Don Ellis Orchestra. And it was this wild 17-piece big band whose thing was to play in odd meters really fast. So, you know, they were playing in 11 time and 17 time and 23 time and these really fast, wild, sometimes Middle Eastern tinged arrangements. Well, half the crowd walked out. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm alive. And that was one of my most memorable concerts, accidentally being turned on to jazz through the Don Ellis Orchestra opening for Judy Collins. So Mark Nesbitt, contributor to the book, The Show I'll Never Forget, 50 Writers Relive Their Most Memorable Concert Going Experience. Thanks for chiming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Sean Manning, editor of The Show I'll Never Forget. 50 writers relive their most memorable concert-going experience. And also joining us now, well, most of the concerts we've heard about have been big shows and big venues, but New York City is a place still where you can see live music in a smaller setting. And our final contributor wrote his essay about one of those clubs, a show he saw at Café Chiné, when it was in the East Village. Mike Albo, who was a guest on this show recently to talk about the novel he wrote with Virginia Heffernan, The Underminer. Mike, welcome back.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Tell us about this concert.
Oh, it was like, I think, 1993, and I just moved to New York from Washington, D.C., and it was in the winter, and I was staying with a super rich friend before I moved into my tiny little eensy-weensy apartment in the East Village, and had no idea where I was, and ended up on St. Mark's in Café Chiné, which at that time was on St. Mark's. And this woman named Katel Koenig sang, and she just started singing, and I totally fell in love with her. And then it started snowing, and it was like this really magical concert. I even think, you know, Café Chiné at the time was this, it was kind of like a little scene. That's where Jeff Buckley and David Gray got their starts. So there's this whole sort of coffee house folksy scene going on at the time. And then I think it was that night, memory is strange, but I think it was that night that I went back home to my friend's place and had some really bad salsa and then had food poisoning the rest of the night.
Great.
It was a very memorable evening.
That'll make it memorable. Let's listen to a little of Katel.
And sweet talk in a town that is no more. If wishful thoughts could bridge the gulf of Araby between.
And Mike Albo, I think there's also a wider sociological theme in your essay as well as a gastronomical one, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it was funny because she is such a supremely talented singer and songwriter, and, you know, my friends and I were just like, well, this woman is going to be like the next Jewel, you know, she's going to be huge. And then we watched her albums come out, and they didn't really click. But at the same time, you know, singers that were tiny pieces of pink dental floss and sing about how sick they are of their own fame became popular. And it was just, it sort of, in a way, just made me realize how people keep their integrity as artists when, you know, the world becomes a giant reality show version of itself.
Now, I have to admit, I'm completely unfamiliar with this artist. Katel, you say Koenig?
I think it's pronounced Katel Koenig. I might be wrong.
K-E-I-N-E-G. And how big did she ever make it?
She's come out with three albums, and she has a huge fan base, and she's still out there. In fact, she's playing this whole month at The Living Room, another really great venue, every Friday. I almost don't want to tell anyone because she's like my best-kept secret. But
shows you what I know about folk
but,
music.
Yeah, she's playing on Fridays at The Living Room this month.
I just left folk music behind after that Judy Collins show. It's just all plugged in stuff after that. Sean, did you also seek out some essays for the book where the artist maybe wasn't as well known or never became as well known? You know, we've heard about the James Browns and the Woodstocks and
right.
stuff like that.
Right. It's actually funny. I've given the book to several of my friends who live in the city, and the first thing they always say about it is, oh, my God, I love Cattell Kenning. I can't believe there's a story of her in there. So maybe not as good a kept secret as Mike would like to think. But, yeah, I really think the one of the wonderful things about the book is that it opens experiences you to artists you may not be familiar with. And that's not only the musicians. I mean, there's a story about Einstürzend Nubatén there, the industrial band, who I was pretty unfamiliar with, and as a result kind of sought them out, and Public Image Limited, there's a wonderful essay on them that was John Lydon's band after the Sex Pistols, and was in many ways more gifted musically, but not maybe as culturally significant. So, and there's this band Metric that's out now that Daniel Handler and Andrew Sean Greer write about that is still kind of not gotten the attention that they will soon to have. But so I think and not only introducing people to acts it might be unfamiliar with, but the writers as well. There's some wonderful writers, including Mike, who are incredible and deserve to be the readership that maybe they haven't received yet.
Let's get a few more callers in here. Steve in Manhattan, what was your memorable concert?
Summer of 65, Bob Dylan, Forest Hills, first act folk, second act electric. The place went berserk in the second act. The folk people were crying. They were upset. The rockers were rocking. It was unbelievable.
Was that a kind of unveiling of his electric side? Did people know that was coming?
I think he had done one concert before that, and it was like a rumor. I mean, you know, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have the kind of news, 24-hour news. So there was like a rumor that he had gone electric, but nobody believed it. And in the first half, obviously, he was doing his usual folk stuff. And then right before the second act, they started bringing these huge amps on stage, and everybody was looking like, what's going on here? What's going on? And all of a sudden he comes out and he starts doing Maggie's Farm, and that was it.
Mm. Steve, thanks a lot. Adam in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Adam.
Brooklyn, just to correct.
Sorry.
That's all right. I was at the 94 reunion of Woodstock, the one that didn't go bad, and... And not to upstage anyone that was at the original Woodstock, the interesting thing was listening to Bob Dylan, and then the Red Hot Chili Peppers came on afterwards. And everyone swaying side to side listening to Dylan. I'm standing next to a big burly guy, 6'5", with a big Confederate flag on one side, and then two traitors from New York on the other side. Joints are being passed left and right. And then the Chili Peppers come on, and I'm in the middle of a mosh pit within about 10 seconds.
And you went, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, they're too young to be at Woodstock. You're frauds, man. Adam, thanks a lot. And Mike Albo, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sean Manning, editor of the show, I'll Never Forget, 50 Writers Relive Their Most Memorable Concert-Going Experience. You jog a lot of people's memory from all kinds of eras. This is really fun.
Brian, I just want to say, you are the man.
Thank you, and I am your media slave, too.